This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from AM 950 Air America, Minnesota, here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Eden Prairie, and regions thereabout. It's such a pleasure being here. One of my favorite parts about downtown Minneapolis is you can wander all over the city without going outside in the dead of winter. So anyhow, today, Anything Goes Friday. We'll be taking your calls throughout the day. I've got a bunch of news to share with you. But first, our first hour, as has been going on 6 years, 5 years anyway, Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, his website, Senator Bernie Sanders, the only independent, or not actually one of two independents in the House of Representatives, the longest serving independent in the history of the House of Representatives. And now over in the United States Senate, and he will be taking your calls at 866-303-2270 in just a few minutes. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Our Brunch with Bernie segment here. Bernie, the energy bill seems the Republicans are steamrolling the Democrats on this thing.
They are. The end result will be we're going to pass something. It is not as strong as it should be. Some of the most important provisions have been taken out of it. And we have to work very, very hard in the coming months to see that we can get those provisions back in. But on the other hand, there are some good provisions in the bill. And it will, in a more significant way than any other piece of legislation I know of, break our dependency on fossil fuel, move us toward energy efficiency, and to such sustainable energies as wind and solar. And that's the good news. Among other provisions, the CAFE standards will be raised by the year 2020 up to 35 miles per gallon. We're now at 25 miles per gallon. We haven't raised them, if you can believe them, in 30 years. I would go much further. As you know, in Europe, Japan, we're talking about 44 miles per gallon today. And here, after this huge struggle against the automobile industry and others, will be at 35 miles per gallon by 2020. Is that enough? No. Is it a step forward? I think it is. There will be increased use of biofuels, and I think that's a step in the right direction. You will see, I think, a lot of movement in terms of more energy-efficient appliances and light bulbs. I just bought an LED light bulb, which will consume one-tenth of the electricity that an incandescent will. It will stay... You could use it for about 20 years.
Wow.
And you're seeing now just breakthroughs in technology every day in terms of that LED, and there's some other types of technologies with regarding to light. So I think this will encourage that development. I think we can save a whole lot of energy as we move to more energy-efficient light bulbs, well beyond the compact fluorescents, which are now expanding all over the country. We got some language in that it would start a energy and environmental block grant program to help cities, towns, states develop energy efficiency and sustainable energy. We've got some money for universities to do the same thing. We've got a workforce development program that I worked on with Senator Hillary Clinton, which what that will do is train people to work in helping to retrofit homes, to install solar photovoltaic units and wind turbines and so forth. What I've always believed as we talk about transforming our energy system away from fossil fuels is that in the process, Tom, I think we can create millions of good-paying jobs. And that's something we're going to focus a whole lot on. So the energy bill was passed in the Senate yesterday. The Republicans, by their filibuster mechanism, managed to take out some of the key provisions, some important provisions, most notably at this point, tax credits, for production and investor tax credits for solar and wind, which is a huge deal, and we've got to get them back in. At some point, we lost by one vote.
In part, didn't they take those out so that they could preserve tax breaks for companies like ExxonMobil, the most profitable company in the history of the world, all the way back to the Roman Empire?
Here's the issue. It was $18 billion, which here in Washington is not a huge sum of money, by the way. And what the provision was, do we take back some of these tax breaks that we gave to the most profitable corporations in world history, ExxonMobil and others, and use that money so that if you want to install a small wind turbine at your home, you will get a tax credit for that. Or if you're in a company that's producing photovoltaics, you will get some help in producing those products. Right now, we are in the cusp, just on the cusp, of exploding those technologies so that more and more Americans will utilize wind turbines, small wind turbines, photovoltaics. I think I've talked in the past about how the thermal, we're going to be seeing thermal solar plants in the Southwest, which are a little bit smaller than nuclear power plants in terms of their production of electricity. And we can produce dozens of them.
So you're talking geothermal like they use in Iceland?
No, not
Iceland?
Not geothermal. Thermal solar. These are solar.
Oh, thermal solar. Oh, okay. Where they have a whole bunch of mirrors that concentrate sunlight on a boiler.
That's right. Exactly right. In terms of the boiler, and that's old technology.
Right.
The thermal collectors are new.
Right.
Pacific Gas and Electric has signed a contract to produce a plant for 550 megawatts, which is the equivalent of a small nuclear power plant. They can produce dozens of these plants in the southwestern part of this country, which is a very optimum area in terms of sunlight.
Sure.
So we can make a giant step forward in producing inexpensive, over a 25-year period, this is inexpensive electricity. It is non-polluting. It is certainly non-emitting of carbon and greenhouse gases. We're sitting there waiting for this to happen.
Right.
And the federal government has been extremely reluctant. I suspect one of the reasons is that it will show the world and this country that we can produce cheaper electricity that way than through coal, for example, clean coal, or through gas and so forth. And there's a resistance on the part of Congress to go forward.
Yeah.
But we've got to move on that issue.
Yeah.
A last point that I want to make is I think people are reading about the budget debates that are taking place here. And I think that for some people, they think this is just old-fashioned political squabbling, you know, what's going on, Democrats, Republicans. It really is not. We're seeing Bush and his friends at their very worst in that what the president wants out of this budget and what he has already gotten is huge increases in military spending. But in terms of education, in terms of health care, in terms of fuel assistance, in terms of Head Start, in terms of virtually any program that would benefit middle-income or lower-income people, Bush wants to level fund, he wants to cut. And what this budget is about is whether we can expand those programs after years and years of neglect or whether we're going to continue to cut them back. I can tell you one area, I have worked very hard on, is to substantially increase funding for what we call community health centers, federally qualified health centers. So we had luck. And I am very nervous now as to what will happen because of Bush's willingness to veto budgets.
Okay, he's threatening over 50 vetoes right now.
Right. And what people should understand is for 6 years, when the Republicans controlled the House and the Senate, when we had earmarks of over $200 million for a bridge to nowhere, when deficit spending was going amok, you know how many vetoes Bush signed?
My recollection is one for stem cells.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. You're right. But nothing on financial issues.
No.
Nothing on economic. Zero.
Nothing to help the middle class.
Well, he did not sign any. Not one veto message. He wasn't concerned about deficit spending as the national debt went up and up and up. But now that some of us want to increase funding so that people don't go cold in this country, so that kids have an opportunity to get a early childhood and Head Start education, so that we can expand educational programs and health care programs, when we want to do that, Bush takes out his veto pen. So if it's tax breaks for the rich, he's there. If it's for more and more spending on the military, he is there. But if it's for programs for the middle class or working families of this country, veto, veto, veto. It is just a horrendous exercise that we are living through right now.
Yeah. We have about a half a minute here, Bernie. You mentioned that the ambassador to Finland had just left.
I did. It's funny. I just met with the ambassador to Finland, and I think one of the issues, and maybe at some point we can spend more time discussing it, Tom, is I think Americans are not aware of some of the huge gains that have taken place in terms of social programs throughout Scandinavia, in terms of their early educational programs, their higher education programs, all of which are virtually free, their very fine healthcare systems, their strong work on the environment. I think we should start paying more attention in this country to some of the advances that other countries have made in eliminating poverty and protecting the environment.
Yeah, it seems like my recollection is they're getting nearly 20% of their electricity from wind power.
That's Denmark.
Oh, Denmark.
Which is a windier country than Finland, but they're doing some good work as well.
The next one over. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program. 16 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270. We'll be taking your calls right after this.
The Tom Hartman program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, broadcasting live from AM 950 Air America, Minnesota, where it's colder than two penguins kissing. I'll be at the University of Minnesota bookstore tonight at 7 o'clock, talking about Cracking the Code, my new book, and signing books. Should be a fine time. We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. And Bernie, before we go to the phone calls, did you want to add something to your comments about Finland
Well, it's not just Finland. I think sometimes, certainly here in Congress, in the House and the Senate, you hear these guys getting up to, oh, we are the greatest healthcare system in the world. We have this, we have that. And yet, if you look how we stand in terms of healthcare, in terms of the kind of wages and benefits that working class and middle class people have, we are far behind many other countries on earth, and it's important that we take a look and see what these countries are doing that we are not doing.
Indeed. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, PC in St. Petersburg, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you. Bernie?
Yes.
I'd like to know why it's apparent that the Democrats in Congress seem to me more concerned about creating an entitlement for illegals than taking care of the citizens that don't have health care. 100 million of us don't have health care, crappy health care. And Kennedy and the liberals and Hillary only care about illegals ahead of the citizens. That's totally unacceptable.
Okay, let me say this, and thank you for asking that question. I don't think it's an accurate statement. I think if you look at what Bush and the Republicans are trying to do in terms of health care, they're trying to cut back on Medicare, they're trying to cut back on Medicaid, you will not hear one word, not one word out of their mouths about the right of all Americans to have health care as a right of citizenship and the right for us to join the rest of the industrialized world. So sometimes what our right-wing friends try to do is pick up on the immigrant issue and they play off Native Americans versus immigrants. And they make a big deal about that. But please do not believe for one second that Republicans want to do anything significant with regard to health care. On his worst day, Ted Kennedy will be trying to do a lot more. Ted Kennedy is a believer, among other things, in a national health care program which provides health care for all Americans. Bush, if that were passed tomorrow, PC, Bush would veto that within a hair's breadth. So I think on that issue, I would rather stick with Kennedy than the right-wing Republicans.
Yeah, I think PC has been listening to too much right-wing talk radio. This is just a quick two sentences here from the Center for American Progress. At the White House Christmas party for the press last night, conservative talk radio talk hosts dominated the place, including Laura Ingraham, Hugh Hewitt, Neil Bortz, Mark Levin, and Paul Smith. During a conversation with WMAL General Manager Chris Berry, whose station features Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh, President Bush smiled, patted him on the back, and said, "Keep it up. We need you guys."
Yep.
I mean, this is
and what I think happens, Tom, and I think PC's question reflected that, is one of the reasons we know as to why Karl Rove and Bush and the Republicans have been so successful is playing off one group of Americans against the other. While they end up taking huge sums of money from the insurance companies or the drug companies and work to make these industries more and more profitable at the expense of the average American. So let's not get caught up in that. Let's not do black against white, gay versus straight, native born against immigrant. Let's try to stand together so that every person in this country can have health care rather than the absolutely absurd situation we have with 45 million uninsured.
Amen. Mike in Queens, New York. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I got a quick question. You know, we're spending an awful lot of money on an embassy. It's really huge. Now, it's my tax.
You mean in Iraq?
I mean in Iraq. Excuse me. Are the oil companies going to be allowed to have an office in there with my tax money going in there? You know what I'm saying?
Well, I don't know for sure, but no, I would think that they would not. But if under this administration, do I think that the embassy will be working close with the oil industry? Yeah, you could bet on it. You could bet on it.
Ralph in Colorado Springs, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you. Senator Sanders, there were a couple of news reports earlier this week that the Pentagon had ordered U.S. military officers not to voluntarily testify in front of Congress. My question is this. How can the Pentagon prohibit U.S. military officers from exercising their constitutional right to petition Congress about possibly unlawful orders?
Well, that is a very good question, Ralph. But we are dealing, as you know, with an administration that doesn't always pay such fine attention to the laws of the land or our Constitution. And when I think we evaluate this administration, I think people will conclude not only is it perhaps the worst, the one of the worst in American history, but in terms of their respect for law, their respect for the Constitution, they will be very close to the bottom, if not at the bottom. You know, we look at these signing laws where the president says, well, thank you for passing this bill. I'm going to sign it. But by the way, I don't intend to enforce this or that section because I don't agree with it. Or I really don't have to, you know, I'm fighting terrorism, which is going to go on forever. And I really don't have to pay too much attention to the Constitution because I'm the commander in chief and I can kind of do anything I want whenever I want. And I don't really have to worry about courts or laws and things like that. So that's what we're up against, Ralph. But hopefully those days will be coming to an end in not too distant future.
Yeah, as Thomas Jefferson said, the reign of witches will end one day soon. It's a tough one. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting live from AM 950 Air America, Minnesota. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I've been rolling down a hill like a snowball headed for hell. With no kind of chance for the flag or the liberty bell. Wishing Ford and Chevy would still last 10 years like they should. The best of the free life behind us now. The good time's really over for good. Stop rolling downhill like a snowball headed for hell.
Thank you, Will. That means stop the Republicans, you understand.
Stand up for the flag and let's all ring the liberty bell. Let's make a Ford and a Chevy that would still last 10 years like they should. Cause the best of the free life is still yet to come. The good times ain't over for good.
No, they're not over. This is the best is still to come. Tom Hartman Program, by the way, brought to you by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. And Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, Tom in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders. Tom? Tom in Wisconsin? Doesn't look like Tom is there. Okay, let's go to Sheila in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Sheila.
Hi there. Say, I was kind of a captive audience with someone who owns a lot of guns. and switched from being a Democrat to a Republican during the 2000 election because of the Democrat, he said, the Democratic position on gun control. And it seems that this group, he says every newsletter from the NRA is pushing for gun owners to vote Republican.
Yes.
This was the only issue. He literally said, I'd rather die than have my gun. I would fight to the death, is what he said, to maintain my right to own guns. And I'd like to know, I mean, I think this is a big voting block that the Democrats could have lost. And I'm wondering what the position is now with the Democrats on gun control.
Well, I'm an independent, not a Democrat, so I can't give you the Democratic position, and I don't know that there's a quote-unquote position. Different members have different points of view. I think, Sheila, though, there is a recognition that what the Republicans have done with great political skill is taken different segments of our society and focused on one particular issue. So for a lot of folks, the issue is gun, and the argument that they are using is, oh, there are some people, some Democrats who want to take away your gun, your right to go hunting. And what they will do is maybe look at some piece of legislation somebody may have entered, which is not going to go anyplace at all, by the way, and use that in their mailings and say, oh, my goodness, they're taking away all your guns. So I think, you know, many Democrats now understand that issue, I think, and understand that what we want to do is make sure that police officers in this country are not shot down by people who can easily acquire guns, but on the other hand, reassure the vast majority of the people. In my state, for example, we have tens of thousands of hunters who have every right in the world to own their guns. So bottom line here, I think this issue has been demagogued a whole lot for political reasons, in the same way that issues over race, over sexual gender, over immigration have been demagogued. And the function of the Republicans in doing that is to split apart people who otherwise would be voting for a progressive economic agenda. So I think this is an issue that Democrats are aware of and are trying to address.
Good. Scott at Denver, Colorado, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good evening, gentlemen, or afternoon, I'm sorry, or morning as it is. I wanted to ask Senator, we mentioned the new energy economy earlier in the program. I was wondering if anything is being done to keep these jobs and create new manufacturing within the U.S. rather than just shipping them off to China.
Scott, great question. Great question. And yesterday the Senate passed the energy bill a week before. We had passed in committee, not the Senate per se, but the Environmental Committee had passed a global warming bill, which will at some point get to the floor of the Senate. We introduced a provision in there, in fact, directly to help American manufacturers in green technology. Your point is well taken. Right now, for a whole variety of reasons, including the lack of interest on the part of the federal government, what you're seeing now is that many of the wind turbines, many of the photovoltaic units are not manufactured in the United States, and that is just totally absurd.
It has to do with our trade policy.
Has to do with our trade policy. It also has to do with the fact that we are not incentivizing and helping some of these manufacturers or those people who might purchase their products, and by helping them, making sure that those products are produced in the United States. So I think Scott asks a very important question. It's something we are working very hard on. Bottom line here is we can create huge numbers of jobs in moving toward a green technology, and I want those jobs created in the state of Vermont in the United States of America and not in China.
Indeed. Andy in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Andy.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. Senator Sanders, a former resident of Ripton, a graduate of Middlebury College, so I thank you for your service to the state of Vermont. Today, we're looking at the Senate Democrats likely to let the phone companies off the hook for domestic spying. The U.S. continues to torture. S-CHIP has been vetoed again. War funding continues, and we see progressives such as Dennis Kucinich literally locked out of the debate. What is our next move as progressives, and why should we come out again in large numbers to support progressive candidates in 08?
Well, Andy, I agree with all of your statements of fact there. And I can go on and on and on. But cynicism and alienation and not participating in the political process is not the answer to that. That is precisely what Bush and Karl Rove want. They want low voter turnouts. They work very hard in trying to suppress the vote. What I would say is, you know, the struggle for progressive politics, the struggle for justice, the struggle for environmental sanity, for women's rights, it's a long struggle. What I can tell you is, in the last year, we have made some advances. The problem, we have passed a higher education bill, which will lower Pell Grants, make it easier for middle-class families to go to college. We just passed an energy bill, which will begin to transform our energy system. We are paying far more attention to veterans than we ever have before. We raise the minimum wage to $7.25 an hour after years and years of neglect. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that we've accomplished a fraction of what I want to see. And some of that is that there are a number of Democrats who are not as progressive as I would like to see. But most importantly, in the United States Senate, right now the Republicans are filibustering every single significant piece of legislation. Yesterday, we got 59 votes to 40 in opposition to do away with tax breaks for the oil companies and use that money to incentivize wind and solar and transform our energy system. We got 59 votes and we lost because you need 60 votes. The Republicans, by the end of this year, will have used the filibuster more, as far as I understand, than any time in American history. That's what we are up against. So what is the answer? The answer is not to give up. The answer is to continue organizing and educating, bringing more and more people into the political process so that we defeat those people who want to continue the war, who want to give more tax breaks to the rich, who are opposed to a national health care program, and to transforming our energy system and paying attention to global warming. That is what we have got to do. And simply sitting around and saying, well, you know, not much is happening is not good enough. The other last point that I would make on that is think where we were a year ago. I am more frustrated than anybody else that we're not moving forward aggressively. I'm seeing work that I have spent a whole lot of time on going down the drain, perhaps, because of Bush's threats to vetoes, one or another bill. But on the other hand, you're not looking now at a Congress that wants to privatize Social Security, make massive cuts in Medicare, and continue to go forward at all kinds of right-wing extremist agenda items. That is not happening. So we have, I think, put a stop to right-wing extremism. We still have a right-wing extremist in the White House, no question about it, but we are making some progress, and we've got to continue that effort. So despair, as we often say, Andy, is just not an acceptable option.
Bob in Delaware, we have about a half a minute here before a break. A quick one?
How do you feel about WTO and NAFTA, Senator? I think that that's the big part of the problem.
Yes, Bob, I agree. We only have a minute here, so let me briefly jump in. I voted against NAFTA when I was in the House. I'm one of the leaders in opposition to our disastrous trade agreements, which have been pushed upon Congress and the American people by large multinational corporations who basically want to move their companies to China, to Mexico, to hire cheap labor and then bring their products back in this country. These trade agreements have been bad for American workers in the middle class here. They resulted in the loss of millions of good-paying manufacturing jobs, pushing wages, and in many cases they're bad for developing countries as well. So I have been one of the leaders in opposition to these trade agreements.
It's our Brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders with us, sanders.senate.gov, his website. He has a newsletter as well you can pick up there. Our number, 866-303-2270. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for the Air America blog. 45 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
No, they've got to figure it out in some of the Scandinavian countries, and we can do it here, too. How about national health care? Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour tonight. It's today, by the way, December 14th. So, you know, if you happen to be hearing a replay of this show on the weekend or something, today is Friday, December 14th, and tonight at 7 o'clock, I'll be at the University of Minnesota Bookstore in Kauffman Union. That's at 300 Washington Street Southeast in Minneapolis. Completely free and open to the public. Doing a speech, a riff, a talk, whatever, on Cracking the Code, the Art and Science of Political Communication, followed by book signing. So show up. Be there, be square. On the line with us, Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's see here, Lou in Fayetteville, Arkansas. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, you're probably one of the few politicians I have any respect left for, but I'd like to ask you one question, and then I'll get off the line.
I'm nervous about this question, though. You probably lose your respect for me after I give you the answer here.
No, it's very. When did the word filibuster become simply a word and not an action? And when is Harry Reid going to demand that if they're going to filibuster, they actually filibuster and not just make a threat of it? And I'll get off the air and listen to your answer.
Well, I think Lou raises a very good question, and it's something that, frankly, Lou is being discussed. Here's the problem that Harry Reid has. Harry Reid has a huge agenda of legislation that has got to be passed for this country to continue to function. Right now, we're working on the farm bill, working on the defense authorization bill. Yesterday, we worked on the energy bill, and so forth. So he has to keep pushing these things along. And what the Republicans know is that because he has the obligation and the duty to get these things passed, if they stall these things out and say, oh, well, we're going to talk now for 3 days on an issue, then Reid is up against the wall in terms of time. But I happen to agree with what Lou is saying, and I think what we have got to do, given the fact that the Republicans are filibustering everything, virtually everything that is important, 50 votes don't win it. You need 60 votes. I think, in my own view, is that what Harry Reid has got to say to the Republicans, you want a filibuster? Well, guess what? We'll be continuing the discussion 3 o'clock in the morning and 4 o'clock in the morning. We'll be here Sunday morning. We'll be here Sunday afternoon. You know, move your kids back here to Washington if you want to see them, because that's what's going to happen. You have the right to filibuster. We have the right to get the work done for the American people. Now, you're going to pay a price if you filibuster. And the American, most importantly, the American people will know better what you are doing. If you want to keep funding this war, fine. We will talk about it for a week and let the American people form their judgment about the wisdom of that, etc. And if you want to deny children in this country the right to have health insurance, we'll talk about that as well. So I kind of believe that should be the strategy. I think the Republicans have taken advantage of, Reid's sense of responsibility of trying to get important legislation through. And I think the answer to that is maybe 24/7. Let's just keep the discussion going.
And when the Democrats start doing that, they'll start winning instead of losing the PR battle, because Americans will figure out what's going on.
That's right.
Right.
And
right
I
now, most Americans are clueless.
Some of the Republicans will say, geez, what does this mean now? If I filibuster, I'm going to have to be here on a Saturday and Sunday, and I can't get home to my district. I can't see my kids. Maybe I shouldn't filibuster.
Yeah. Amen. Frank in Middletown, New York, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi. I got to tell you, Senator, I wish we had a House and Senate full of Bernie Sanders, we'd be a lot better off. But I'm beginning to feel awfully sorry for you. Every week you come on this show and you try your best to justify something that those of us out here, good lifelong Democrats, are beginning to have a perception of. And it's that if the Republican-controlled Congresses of the last several years have been arguably the most corrupt, then this one, this Democratic-controlled Congress has been the most inept. I got to ask you a question. If there were an LBJ in the Senate right now, if there were a Tip O'Neill in the House, in spite of the numbers, I'll guarantee you we'd be getting stuff done.
Well, let me just say this, Frank, and you're more than entitled to your opinion. And I think we can do a better, as I just mentioned to Lou a moment ago, I think we have got to be more aggressive. And I think that in addition to the problem of 60 votes on many days, we are lacking 4 presidential candidates. So actually the Republicans have more people on the floor than our side does. But having said all of that, I think we do need a new tactic. And I think that tactic is to say to the Republicans, if you want a filibuster, you can filibuster. And we're going to be here 24-7, and you're going to share some of the pain. So I think we need to be more aggressive. I think the American people need more clearly than they understand it now to understand what the differences are. What does Bush's budget mean to the children of this country, to the older people of this country, to the sick people of this country, as opposed to the kind of budgets that some of us are trying to push? So I think we've got to be more aggressive, and I hope I will do my best to make that happen when we return in January.
Don in Colorado, we got about a minute left here. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I want to know, correct me if I'm wrong, we just voted in the Judiciary Committee to hold Rove and his deputy in contempt of the Congress.
I believe that is.
We're supposed to go to votes in the Senate, is that correct?
I believe the Judiciary Committee did that. That is correct.
Okay, so I want to know if you will help lead the charge to force a vote on the floor to do that. And then when it goes to the new attorney general and he lets it sit on the table, I would I want to know if you'll lead the way to have the House invoke their contempt and get these guys arrested by the sergeant of arms and take them in there and do what's responsible for the American citizens.
Well, I think you have had a very dishonest administration. I think in many ways they have acted unconstitutionally. And I will do my best to make them held accountable.
Well said. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, the website. Bernie, again, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Take care.
Yeah, good talking with you. Week after week, year after year. Bernie Sanders is he's got more time in the chair than a lot of talk show hosts. It's Anything Goes Friday. We'll be back with your calls at 866-303-2270. A little news of the day right after this. Stick around.
Tom Hartman Program for your minimum daily adult requirements of sanity. Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Well, for the first time in 3 years, welcome back to the program, by the way. For the first time in 3 years, this is amazing. An intelligence authorization conference bill is coming out of Congress. Most of the budget is classified. This is a $43 billion piece of legislation. But it does block spending. There's a number of things in here. It blocks spending on about 70%, about three-quarters of the intelligence budget, until the administration briefs the House and Senate Intelligence Committees on the airstrike against Syria conducted back on September 6th by Israel. It also prohibits waterboarding, mock executions, and other torture techniques, essentially, techniques that cause people to think that they're dying, or that may, in fact, put them at risk of dying or put them in great pain. And the Bush administration has said this week that this first intelligence authorization conference bill in 3 years, that they're gonna veto it. George doesn't like being held accountable. And he really likes the idea of torturing people, apparently. I mean, that's, I don't know what else we can say about this. This is, and here's the bigger picture, I think, frankly, beyond just the intelligence bill. In fact, by the way, where did it go here? That's not it. The folks who were originally being charged with I have lost the story. This is we're doing our show here live, by the way, from Air America Minnesota, AM 950, and it's not the studio I'm used to, so something just vanished here. The guys who were from down in Miami, I believe that there were six of them who were basically the FBI came in and convinced them that they were a bunch of Middle Eastern sheikhs and that they were going to give them a lot of money if these guys would stand up in front of a camera and swear allegiance to Osama bin Laden And the administration touted this as, you know, we've stopped this attempt on the Sears Tower in Chicago where they're going to blow it up and all this. And these guys, you know, they were pathetic. They were pathetic. And what they were doing, it turns out, they wanted to build a community center in their neighborhood, and they thought that they would take the money from these sheikhs. And, you know, if they said, yeah, we like Osama bin Laden, they'd get the money. And a jury just found them not guilty, basically, the bottom line. So here we have virtually no convictions of any consequence in this so-called war on terror. Bill Clinton actually put people in jail. That's what you do when they commit crimes. George Bush instead just wants to shred the Constitution and torture people. Doesn't matter if there's any convictions. No convictions as a consequence of information that has come as a result of, so quote, torture. And as far as we can tell, no, there have been no plots foiled. There have been some plots that, you know, like this one, that have been trumpeted. But this is one that wouldn't have happened if the FBI hadn't gone in and said, hey, you know, stand up in front of the camera and say you like Osama. We'll give you $50,000. In fact, yeah, here's this story from Reuters. Mistrial for six in Sears Tower conspiracy. A judge declared a mistrial on Thursday for six men accused of plotting to blow up America's. So it's not guilty. It's a mistrial. And, I mean, this defense lawyers dismissed the charges as nonsense, said the entire plot was orchestrated by paid FBI informants. Narciel Batiste, who prosecutors said was the group's ringleader, testified that he went along with the informants who posed as Middle Eastern contacts in a bid to con them out of $50,000 to support an inner-city religious group. So a mistrial. This is the kind of brilliant prosecution that's being brought about. So in this context here, and you see this, you know, the CIA, the intelligence budget now, looks like the Bushies are going to veto that. Let's just put this into a larger context and look at the legislation and can tip of the hat to Kagro X over at the Daily Kos for compiling this list. The legislation that the Bush administration has vetoed or is threatening to veto. The Medicare Prescription Drug Price Negotiation Act and the Medicare Fair Prescription Drug Price Act, House Resolution 4, Senate Bill 3. Bush is going to veto these. Why? Well, they would lower prices on prescription drugs for the middle class and reduce profits for some of the obscenely profitable multinational, transnational pharmaceutical companies. The Employee Free Choice Act that would allow people to simply vote and say, yeah, I'd like to sign this card and say I want to be in the union. Oh, we can't have that. We got to make it very, very complicated, difficult, and allow the employers to control the process. The Improving America's Security Act, Senate Bill 4. The Water Quality Financing Act. The Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act. Well, we can't have whistleblowers after all. They might tell the American people what's going on in this corrupt administration or this corrupt, frankly, what's behaving, particularly when you look at the Don Siegelman case down in Alabama, this political party that's being run like the mob. The Presidential Records Act of 2007. He's going to veto that. Oh, he doesn't want to be accountable. The U.S. Troop Readiness, Veterans Health, and Iraq Accountability Act. He's going to veto that. The D.C. Voting Rights Act. He's going to veto that. The Rail and Public Transportation Security. These are all threats to veto. The Rail and Public Transportation Security Act. Oh, we can't have more money spent on infrastructure. We've got to give tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires. And whatever money we do spend on the credit card that our kids and grandchildren will pay for, whatever money we do spend has to go to military contractors after all, the good buddies of Cheney and Rumsfeld and the Bush family, frankly, the Carlyle Group. The Food and Drug Administration Revitalization Act. The Stem Cell Enhancement Act. The Redeployment of United States Armed Forces and Defense Contractors from Iraq Act. The Department of Homeland Security Authorization Act. The Agriculture Disaster Assistance in Western States Emergency Unfinished Business Appropriations Act. Do you get it? Bush is saying, oh, if it has to do with the average person, if it has to do with building American infrastructure, if it has to do with anything that might help this country, he's going to veto it because that's big government. That's socialism. It's not big government, of course, when you take a company that basically is running a shooting range and turn them into a multi-billion dollar private army, especially when their president is the brother-in-law of a guy running for as the Republican for governor of Michigan and, you know, very wealthy and powerful family. No, that's not big government. That's not welfare. The No Oil Producing and Exporting Cartels Act. The Human Price Gouging, or excuse me, the Federal Price Gouging Prevention Act. The Department of Homeland Security Appropriation Act. The Creating Long-Term Alternatives to Nation Act, Energy Independence and Security Act. The State Foreign Operations and Related Programs Appropriation Act. These are all things that the White House has said they will veto if they get passed. And many of them will not even get passed because the Republicans are filibustering them in the Senate. The Financial Services and General Government Appropriations Act. The College Cost Reduction Act. Oh, we can't have that. What, reduce the cost of college? Then you can't have a meritocracy where only the very wealthy can get a college education and have rule by a wealthy and meritorious elite. The core concept of conservative worldview and governance, philosophy of governance. The Responsible Redeployment from Iraq Act. Oh, no, we're not going to redeploy out of Iraq. Are you kidding? The Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development and Related Agencies Appropriations Act. What? Money for housing? Transportation? Urban development? Help the cities? Are you kidding? The Department of Commerce and Justice, Science, and Related Agencies Appropriations Act. The Farm Nutrition and Bioenergy Act, Food and Energy Security Act. Oh, we can't have that. What? To help the small farmers? The Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. Fair pay? What? Can't have that. The Children's Health Insurance Reauthorization Act, otherwise known as S-CHIP. The Agriculture, Rural Development, Food and Drug Administration Related Agencies Appropriations Act. I mean, these are all things that the Bush administration has said that they will veto or Republicans in the Senate are filibustering. Ensuring Military Readiness Through Stability and Predictability Deployment Act. The Renewable Energy and Energy Conservation Tax Act. The New Direction for Energy Independence, National Security, and Consumer Protection Act. Reauthorizing the FAA. Now, there might still be some guys there who are getting decent pay. We can't have that. They might even have a pension. We can't have that. No, we got to privatize the whole thing. Let's farm it out to maybe Walmart will create a division for it. The Flood Insurance Reform and Modernization Act. The Government Accountability Act. Oh, can't have that. National Affordable Housing Trust Fund? Nope, not a chance. Free Flow of Information Act? No way. Employment Non-Discrimination Act? Nope, can't have that. Homeowners Defense Act? Not a chance. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Anything goes Friday. Well, Harry Reid is showing a backbone. You know, during the Thanksgiving recess, so that Bush could not recess appoint any more toxic judges or agency heads or anything like that, Harry Reid said every 3 days somebody is going to show up in the Senate and, you know, read a paragraph or two, and technically the Senate will be in session, and there will not be a recess, so Bush cannot use recess appointments. And we all applauded and said, go get him, give him hell, Harry. And he did. He, God bless him. We should all be calling Senator Reid's office and saying, you know, that was wonderful what you did on the Thanksgiving recess. And now I understand he's probably going to do the same thing for the Christmas recess. So, if you go to callcongress.org, you can get the phone number. You can call Senator Reid's office and say, Senator Reid, thank you. Thank you so much for what you're doing. Some amazing news. 650,000-year news in the front page of the Marketplace section of today's Wall Street Journal. I'll share that with you in a few minutes. But first, let's get to the phones here at 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Any topic you want to talk about, fine with me. Brenda in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Brenda, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Welcome to Minnesota. I hope you enjoy yourself while you're here, even though it's cold.
Well, thank you. I am. I love Minnesota. I mean, this is the Midwest. I grew up in Michigan, and
yeah.
So, you know, and lived in both the lower and the upper peninsula. So this is just like, in fact, I'll be there tomorrow. I'm going back to visit family. So this is home.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. I just wanted to ask, I have an opinion on something, and I just wondered if you would agree with me and if you do agree with me, why you think it's so. It seems to me that Americans are so willing to contribute money or help when huge tragedies happen that are splashed all over the news, like 9/11 or Katrina or the bridge falling in Minneapolis. But everyday tragedies that can go on for years, they look the other way. Or they think maybe people did something, made a poor choice to deserve what happened to them. And if I could give you an example, when I was a baby, my father was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic, and my mother had, I'm a little nervous.
That's okay.
I'll try to calm down. My mother had three children under 5 years old, and she never received any kind of help. And that's fine, you know, but...
I don't think it is fine. It's, you know.
Well, she made it all right, and we made it all right. But I'm wondering why people seem so willing to look the other way and blame people when these tragedies happen that are ongoing, that last for years.
I think, Brenda, there's a strong strain of Calvinism in the United States, not the modern Calvinist church that's based in the town I was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan, but the original Calvinist church started by John Calvin, who suggested that things should be basically run as a meritocracy. This was in response to the Catholic position at the time, you know, a couple hundred years ago, that the Catholic Church should be a political as well as a and had been for 1,000 years, you know, a political as well as a religious or spiritual institution. And Calvin's suggestion was, instead of, you know, the Pope being in charge, we should have people who are blessed by God, you know, similar to the perspective of the Catholics. But how do you know that they're blessed by God? Well, the fact that they're wealthy proves that they're blessed by God, that was a visible sign of God's blessing. And I think to this day there are a lot of Americans who deep down, you know, at some bizarre unconscious level, buy into that Calvinistic notion that, you know, and it's been really a part of America's history. You go back to the late 19th century, and there were two large waves of immigration into the East Coast in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, the Irish, and in the 1880s, 90s, and around 1900, the Italians. And in both cases, as those immigrants came in, these large numbers of immigrants, they were very poor, and there was a very high level of crime in their neighborhoods, in large part because of their poverty and because they were exploited by employers. And what came out of that wasn't, gee, let's help these poor folks. What came out of that was a whole huge body of so-called scientific literature trying to figure out what the genetics were of the criminality of the Irish and the Italians. And you know, two, three generations later, when they finally got on their feet and got their acts together, nobody was talking about that anymore. But it's like, it's the blame the victim mentality.
So you do think that Americans are more that way?
I think that it's human nature. I think that you'll find that in every country in the world. Unfortunately, here in the United States, we have carved a fair amount of it into public policy, and some of that goes back to the Calvinist and the Puritan founders of this country who openly subscribed to those beliefs, and some of it, you know, it's interesting. De Tocqueville, in his Democracy in America in 1834, came over from France, and he was arguing more or less that a weak kingdom like England has right now really is kind of a good thing, because it takes away that head of state part. It takes away that sense of there's somebody in charge who, or somebody at least at the head of state, who is there because they're hereditarily there, and therefore you don't have to have a meritocracy. I don't think I'm describing this particularly well, but the point is that he thought that would actually diminish this pernicious thing that he saw in the United States. Brenda, thank you very much for your call
and
for your story. But the solution to the problem, frankly, I think you look, as Bernie was saying, look at the countries of Northern Europe, and particularly the Scandinavian countries. They got to figure it out.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Be careful of what you say. Be careful in every way. Be careful of what you do. Big Brother is watching you. Be circumspect and discreet. Stay light on your mental feet. One slip and you know you're through. Big Brother is watching you. Conform with all directives. Remember, obedience pays. And when you watch that TV screen, remember it works both ways. You'll disappear in a wink, unless you can double think. You'll vanish into the blue. Big Brother is watching you.
Oh, no. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live today from AM 950, Air America, Minnesota. Tom Hartman program brought to you by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. And just a quick reminder, tonight at 7 o'clock at the University of Minnesota Bookstore, Kauffman Union, 300 Washington Avenue Southeast in Minneapolis. That's tonight, December 14th, 7 p.m. I will be there, free and open to the public. We're talking about our new book, Cracking the Code. Just to boil down a simple answer to the last caller's question. Number one, the very best anti-poverty program in the world is a good job, like a good union job where workers have some say in what they're paid and where, you know, and the conditions under which they work and those kind of things. Number one. And number two is a decent social safety net. And these are both things that conservatives have historically fought against, and they have historically fought against them because when you have a strong and empowered middle class, you have basically a strong and empowered uppity class, a class that will challenge the power of the elites. And conservatives do not like that. I mean, that's the bottom line. The first, go read Russell Kirk's The Conservative Mind, the book published in 1953 that has become the Bible of the modern conservative movement. And the first chapter, all about order and class, how a society, in order to be stable, and stability is the highest value, in order for a society to be stable, there must be a very clearly defined class and order to people. And economics is in the United States is the way that is defined. We don't have kingdoms here. That's what's referred to as a meritocracy. Those who are most meritorious end up running things. So anyhow, 1-866-303-2270. John in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
What you were just talking about, that's why Bush worked so hard to destroy or is trying to destroy the civil service system.
Yep.
That's why he opposed the Department of Homeland Security when it was first proposed.
Yeah, because it was going to be unionized.
Exactly. The reason I'm calling, I want to ask you to stop making sense. Stop appealing to people's reason. Stop trying to change minds. If they don't care about ideologues and science advisory panels, if they don't care about James O'Byrne asking about Roe v. Wade when he's hiring the people to rebuild the electrical system in Iraq, if they don't care about preventative war or torture or politicized Justice Department prosecuting people based on party, let me tell you something they will care about. They will care about the cut in capital gains if it's explained to them. The most informed people that I know, Tom, don't know about the cut in capital gains. They don't know that we got by 100 years without coupon clippers paying half the tax rate that they pay.
Yeah, they don't realize that Henry Kravitz is paying 15% more or less income tax maximum rate.
Yeah,
because
I haven't found a single person, and I'm talking about the informed people that I know. You tell them, and they're shocked because it's not reported anywhere.
You know, it blew my mind. This was a major centerpiece of the tax reform legislation that George Bush and the Republicans pushed through Congress 3 years ago, and that if you earn your living by the sweat of your brow or by physical labor or thought, in other words, if you get a paycheck, if you have a wage, then the top income tax rate is in the low 30s. I think it's, what, 36% now, something like that. Say that again?
Yes, I think you're right.
I think it's 36%. And on the other hand, if you earn your living sitting around on your butt waiting for the dividend check to arrive, or they're not really venture capitalist guys, they're the arbitrage guys, you know, the new masters of the universe. If you earn your living buying companies, well, like Bain Financial, Mitt Romney's old company, if you earn your living buying companies, pumping them up, splitting them apart, selling them off, and then making money on the profit of the sale, that's called capital gains, and the maximum income tax you will pay is 15%.
Right. And it's even worse than that, because Warren Buffett, God bless him, he opposes this, but he can only use so much gasoline in a day for his personal use. He can only eat so much food that he pays sales tax on. So really the bottom line is that we down here in the 30K, 40K, 50K range, we're really paying about three times as much overall in taxes as those people are.
Yeah.
So if to appeal to people's selfishness, because reason doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
Thanks
sounds,
a lot, Tom.
Thank you, John. Sounds like a real reasonable approach, and I do talk about that a lot on this program, actually, and you're right, I should talk about it more. It's just amazing that people who sit on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive in the mail pay half the interest rate or pay half the income tax rate of somebody who actually works for a living. Just wrong. Todd in Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, Todd, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing?
Just great. What's up?
I love the show, and you've helped me frame in words a lot of thoughts that I've had for a long time, and so you've really helped me out in that way. And I'd like to help you out with something that I see as a blind spot of yours.
Okay.
On Tuesday, you were talking about atheism with one of the people that was on the program, or one of the callers, and
mm-hmm.
I think you've got a blind spot in three aspects when it comes to atheism. One is that you were referring to atheism as an ism. And
those are the last three letters of the word.
Right, but you're parsing the word incorrectly. It's not atheism, it's atheism.
Oh, you're right. You're
so
right.
It's the
lack of theism. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So referring to atheism as an ism is incorrect.
Yeah, okay, I'll give you that.
And
you're
then
right.
You were also comparing atheism to agnosticism. And if we were all honest, we're all either agnostics or delusional.
Well, that's the point that I made about myself last week. And,
right.
and it's funny,
right.
I got email from people saying, how can you call yourself a Christian? Because I said on the air, I don't know what's going to happen when I die.
Right.
I have a belief about what's going to happen.
Exactly.
But I don't know.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I'll put it right out front. You know, I call myself a Christian, and that is a religion. And because it is, you know, belief in something that is unprovable, intangible, and may well be irrational. But it's mine, and I believe it. Okay.
Right, exactly.
And frankly, I think that evangelical atheists, those people who say, no, you're absolutely wrong, there is no, there is nothing beyond what we can see and measure and sense, period. There is no great intelligence in the universe, there is no, there are no, you know, thousands of entity, you know, pantheism, there are no thousands of deists or deities in the world, you know, the stream doesn't have its own spirit, its own, or isn't a god or whatever, or, you know, there isn't a singular god or multiple god, you know, we can prove all that's right. If they're evangelical about it, I would submit to you that they're behaving like members of a religion behave.
I would think that if you're evangelical about anything, whether it's, you know, Red Sox versus Yankees, or it's, you know, any of those things that you have as a belief system,
then it's a religion. I agree.
Then you behave.
I agree. In fact, I would submit to you that the Milton Friedman School of Economics coming out of the Chicago School is a religion. And in fact, it's a false religion. And arguably, you could say the same thing about neocons and Al-Qaeda and, you know, I mean, people, you know, all of these folks who are subscribing to things and building their worldview around them and being very evangelic. Sure. Yeah. I'll give you that.
I guess my last point was that was a caveat to what we were just talking about, where when it comes to government, which is what so much of, you know, your program deals with, is how we treat each other and how we use the commons and things of that nature, is that, you know, coming from the point of view of someone who might be an atheist, if they're looking at all the different religions as people arguing over Superman versus Batman and, well, in issue 137 they did this, yeah, but in issue 200 they did that, it doesn't really matter. But if the president is a Trekkie and he wants to open up every speech with, you know, captain's log, stardate 6729, that gets a little annoying. If they start if they close every speech with, instead of God bless America, they close it with live long and prosper, then that starts getting a little bit annoying. But when they try and pass laws that are based on those religions, that's, you know, then you get into the whole separation of church and state. And so that's where I think that some atheists that might come off as evangelical are sort of backed into a corner.
Because they're pushing back against the theists.
Right, they're essentially pushing back
the theocrats.
Kind of thing that we take Congress to task for all the time, that if you let the opposition frame the argument, then you've already lost the battle.
No, Todd, I agree with you. However, or perhaps I should say, and, you got people like Barry Lynn out there, and you got people like me out there, you got people who consider themselves spiritual or religious people who are aggressively pushing back against theocracy in the United States.
Oh, sure, sure. But I think that you have to.
And that doesn't make us atheists.
To do it in their own way as well.
Sure. Yeah.
Because if you start talking about the.
You know, when I suggest that evangelical atheists are members of a religion, I am not putting them down. I'm putting them in the same category as myself.
Right. Right.
It's not an. You know, in my mind, it's not an insult. It kind of boggles my mind all the email and frankly hate mail that I've gotten for
right.
saying that. It's really incredible.
Yeah, for me it's a matter of I don't believe in ghosts or Bigfoot, but if it showed up, hey great, I'm wrong. That's
okay.
My approach to it.
Yeah, there you go. So that's not a religion, that's more the agnostic realm, I would say. But Todd, thanks a lot for a reasonable conversation on a topic that is very often unreasonable. 45 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Yeah, my theme song here.
Nobody knows if it's something to bless or to blame.
And speaking of crazy, the silver-haired protesters, this Joseph Rose's piece in the Oregonian today, the statewide newspaper in Oregon, out of Portland. Protester grannies found not guilty is the headline. The punchline of this is mind-boggling. The silver-haired this is the opening of the article. The silver-haired protesters who showed up weekly outside the Northeast Portland Military Recruiting Center last spring typically sat in rocking chairs holding anti-war signs. But on Good Friday, half a dozen members of the local group calling itself the Serious PO'd Grannies, this is the name of the group, tried something more radical. Members used red finger paint to leave handprints on a front window along with the number 3627, 3,627, at that date, the body count of U.S. service members killed in Iraq. On Thursday, after a three-day trial in which the prosecutor likened them to terrorists, five grannies, actually four women and a man, ages 56 to 76, were acquitted on misdemeanor criminal mischief charges. But here, listen to the closing arguments by Multnomah County District Attorney Seth Stewart. He called on the jury to convict the grannies, quote, and these are his words, not a characterization of his words. These are his words. To protect our troops. He said, think of some evils that could happen and why it's important for the line to be drawn here. On September 11, some people drove planes into a building to prove a point. The defendants say their conduct is necessary to avoid imminent danger because people are dying in Iraq. That is the same thing suicide bombers say. Well, apparently the jury thought that Seth's arguments were as crazy as they sound. It took them 30 minutes to acquit the grannies. I still have this 650,000-year-old news to share with you. We'll get to that in the next hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Anna in Greeley, Colorado. Hey, Anna, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. How are you doing?
Just great.
Okay.
But I'll get better. What's up?
Okay. I won't. But I don't call myself an atheist. I call myself a person who doesn't believe it necessary to postulate the existence of a supreme being.
Yeah, see, I think that's an agnostic.
No.
No? Okay.
No.
So you're...
I haven't believed... since I was 8 years old in Sunday school and heard the Bible being read.
Yeah.
I was in Oklahoma at the time.
Uh-huh.
I grew up there, and that means I've been a Democrat forever because that's all we had at that time.
Uh-huh.
But what I wonder is, you know, you always talk about Ronald Reagan's policies. Well, they were really the policies of the Knights of Malta. And the Democrats were in the majority then, and they voted for everything that came along from the Democrats.
Well,
from
you know,
the Republicans.
Here's the problem, Anna. When you say they, when you're talking about the Democrats,
they're the same one.
There's no such thing as a Democratic Party. There's the Democratic Coalition. You've got conservatives in the Democratic Party. You've got, or you know, elected officials among the Democrats who are arguably more conservative than some Republicans, like Olympia Snow, for example, or even Chuck Hagel these days. And you've got true progressives among the Democrats. And then you got a bunch of, you know, get along, go along in the Democrats. You got some corporatists.
The Blue Dog Democrats.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, it's frankly, I think that this is part of the strength of the Democratic Party, even though it doesn't help them necessarily always legislatively get one particular agenda accomplished, it's that the Democratic Party actually is small d democratic. It does still have a big tent. The Republican Party has done a very, very effective purge. And basically, it's the interests of transnational corporations and the interests of hardcore right-wing religious zealots. And that's it.
I used to call them all the time and ask, please, don't vote to kill people in Central America for the sake of wiping out liberation theology.
Right.
But they did anyway. I mean,
yeah,
the people, they're still there. David Obey's one, for example. They're all of them. I mean, we got Salazar here who voted against the farm bill. Now, Allard voted for it, which is, just blew my mind because Allard has never voted for it. He's a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
For the people, but my agenda is restoration of the Constitution and really sticking with giving it to everybody.
Yeah. Now there's a religion we can all buy into.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anna, thank you very much. Very, very well said, and it's very much what we need to be doing, what we absolutely need to be doing. George in Colorado. Hey, George.
Hey, Tom. Spinning off of what you just said with that last caller, I think that it's very important, and I think it's an excellent opportunity for the Democratic Party to come up with a consistent definition. And I think
of what?
That, for one thing, that we are clear about the policy. That, I mean, for example, one thing we really need to do is point out the inconsistencies in the Republican definition. For example, they push social conservatism down everybody's throats. They have become a laissez-faire party. Their definition revolves around pragmatism, which is the most inconsistent thing with this principle.
Well, first of all, I'd say they're not pragmatic, George, and secondly, I wouldn't say they have recently become this way. The Republican Party has been pretty much the way it is right now since the 1880s. They got a little more rational during Eisenhower's presidency, but that was about it.
Well, I mean, pragmatic in as far as, I mean, compared to laissez-faire economics. I mean, that's really what they're all about.
Yeah.
They're not conservative. They do for the sake of big business.
No, and that is conservative. You know, the conservative worldview is that you have to have orders and classes, that society should be ruled by a small number of people who are the most meritorious, that one of the definitions of merit is easily found by looking at whether somebody has wealth or not. I mean, just read their writings. This is not a secret that the conservative worldview is very, very close to aristocracy. Alexander Hamilton, one of the first conservatives, said we should have presidents elected for life. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Call 866-303-2270. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. The front page of the second section of today's Wall Street Journal the Science Journal column by Robert Lee Hotz, or Hotz, I'm not sure how he pronounces it, H-O-T-Z. Talks about the world's largest volcano. This is Mauna Loa, or Mauna Loa, the island of Hawaii, the big island. They put sensors up on top of that thing to measure air, you know, the air of the world in one of its purest places. For half a century, sensors atop Mauna Loa on the island of Hawaii have captured the worldwide signature of increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere due largely to burning coal, oil, and natural gas. Carbon dioxide traps heat. For 50 years, these CO2 readings, known as the Keeling Curve, by the way, they're named after the guy who, in 1958, started this thing as a way of, you know, testing the hypothesis back then that excess carbon dioxide would simply be absorbed by the oceans. And we know that an awful lot of it has been, although the oceans are now becoming so acidic from all this carbonic acid, the carbon dioxide dissolved in the oceans, that it's changing the nature of life in the oceans, and it's also maybe close to reaching a saturation point, which apparently means that the atmosphere is going to start loading carbon dioxide even faster. So anyhow, back to the article. For 50 years, these CO2 readings, known as the Keeling Curve, have been climbing steadily, setting and then breaking a new record every 12 months or so. Keep in mind, the first three words of that sentence were, for 50 years. Global concentrations of CO2 in 2006, not surprisingly, then reached the highest level since the record keeping began in 1958. The World Meteorological Organization recently announced in its annual greenhouse gas bulletin, based on samples from 40 countries, the level of carbon dioxide in the air reached 381.2 parts per million, concentrations not seen in 650,000 years. Scientists said. This week, while diplomats from 180 countries, writes Robert Lee Hotz over in the Wall Street Journal today, this week, while diplomats from 180 countries argued over the cost of staving off predicted climate change, the Mauna Loa readings started to approach even higher levels. It's here, it's real, and none of the Republicans would raise their hands. And in yesterday's Democratic debate, I think it was Hillary Clinton, she said, I want to raise my hand on that question. The moderator said, we're not asking that question. We're not asking. Well, I want to raise my hand anyway. We believe that global warming is real. It's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of looking at the sensors. This is not rocket science, or maybe it is, but it's there. 650,000 years ago. Let me remind you that 650,000 years ago, we, in our current form anyway, humans were not on this planet. The as far as we can tell, the oldest fossils of Homo sapiens sapiens, us, you, me, are about 165,000 years old. So this was three times, arguably four times longer, well, three times, let's say, longer than humans have been on Earth. That's the atmosphere that we're bringing back. That's the climate that we're bringing back. And it may well not be all that hospitable to us. Time will tell. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Anything goes Friday. Ellen in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Are you talking to me?
Yes, sir. Only
hey, Tom.
You don't sound like Ellen.
Alan,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, hey Tom, I've heard you do a lot of interviews with libertarians, and I was wondering, I never heard you ask them what their vision for a future is. Like if they were to get their way in terms of laws and regulations, what they see the country looking like 20, 50, 100 years from now. I mean, I have an idea of what it might look like 1890s America, but
yeah,
I wonder what they think it would look like.
1890s America was a pretty libertarian time, as was, you know, 18th and 19th century England, Victoria era England, a very libertarian time. But, you know, looking back on the short while back in the late 70s that I was hanging out with libertarians, and I had a bumper sticker, as I recall, Harry Brown was running for president and had a bumper sticker that said, freedom works, vote libertarian. I mean, you know, it's a very seductive and appealing philosophy, frankly, until you really dig deeply into it. And I don't purport to speak for the libertarians, and you know, they we bring them on the program to do that themselves, they do probably a much better job than me. But broadly speaking, in answer to your question, Alan, the idea is that there's first of all, there's a germ of truth. And one of the points that Milton Friedman made, the Chicago School economist who recently died, who is kind of the father of modern conservative economics and modern libertarianism in some ways. And that is that if you're going to try to regulate or control an economy based on data and information, it's going to be impossible because the data and information changes, you know, 100 million bits of data and information change every second. And frankly, you know, this controlled economy like the Soviet Union had is not what liberals, progressives, frankly, historically, Americans have suggested. They haven't suggested, let's try to, you know, micromanage prices on a moment-by-moment basis kind of thing. Instead, it's, let's set the rules of the game. And then within the confines of the rules of the game, that labor actually does have a place at the table, that there is a minimum wage, that there are going to be certain protections for labor, things like that. Within those, that corporations must operate within the public interest. Within the rules of the game, then the game can be played. Libertarians suggest that there shouldn't be essentially any rules outside of rules against the use of force or fraud. And the major place where that fails, there's a couple places where it fails. The first is, by and large, libertarians don't acknowledge the commons, beyond the commons of police, you know, of the enforcement of the laws against force and fraud. And so the ownership of common land, for example, national parks, would be opposed. I mean, that's socialism. That's the government owning something. The ownership of us, we the people, asserting ownership over air and water and saying that we have some right in saying how clean it has to be or must be or what happens to people who pollute, that gets set aside. And the theology of it, essentially, and here we are back to that religion word, is that if you allow individuals' self-interest, greed is good. If you allow self-interest to drive all decisions, eventually that self-interest will get around to figuring out what's best for it and for everybody else, and the world will become a paradise. The problem is that it doesn't anticipate harms, that harms are always retroactive, that if a company comes along and says, or a person comes along and starts selling poison as medicine, then you can prosecute them for fraud or for violence, for harm, but people have already died. And so, you know, libertarians argue against there being any regulatory agencies, and in a very small community, you know, much like communism works in small communities, like on the in kibbutz in Israel, you know, as long as everybody knows everybody, then pooling everybody's property works, because nobody is going to behave sociopathically and just start hoarding everybody else's property and keeping it away from them. But communism breaks down when you get beyond about 150 people. Similarly, libertarianism, in my opinion, breaks down when you get beyond 150 people. And in fact, I would submit that it doesn't even work then, because at the level of tribe or clan, which is more or less 150 people or large extended family, there is a strong sense of commons, of we're in this together. And the libertarian worldview is, no, it's me. I'm in it for me. And as long as everybody's in it for themselves, in a really aggressive way, then ultimately the common good will be served. And the fact of the matter is that there has never been a successful libertarian society in the world.
Yeah, well, that's the part I didn't understand, is how can you serve your own self-interest and expect other people to benefit from that? I mean, it never made any sense to me that they would think that, well, this rising tide would lift all peoples all over the world. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense, that philosophy.
No, and it doesn't work. And as the shades of libertarianism that you see, for example, the World Bank and the WTO and organizations like this trying to impose these on countries. And I mean, there was a great example we talked about a week or two ago about one of the African nations that has been experiencing famine for years. And the World Bank has been saying, you know, we will not loan you money if you're going to subsidize fertilizer for your people. And I think it was Sierra Leone. I could be wrong. And they finally said, no, we're going to subsidize fertilizer. You guys do it in the United States. The Europeans do it. We're going to do it. And we don't care what the World Bank says. And this year they became, for the first time, instead of a net importer of grains, an exporter of food. And you know, because they said this is part of the commons. Our food supply is part of the commons. We are all going to collectively pitch in for it. So, Alan, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it and bringing up the topic. 16 minutes. Maybe some libertarian wants to come and defend themselves. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
Anything goes.
Live from AM 950, Air America, Minnesota. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. And you will hear me, if you live in the Minnesota area, you will hear me riff about that a little more tonight at 7 o'clock at the University of Minnesota Bookstore at Kauffman Union, 300 Washington Avenue Southeast in Minneapolis. Completely free and open to the public. We're going to have a lot of fun. Looking forward to it. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Chris in Carson, California. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. And I thought I'd put in a call in purgatory.
Yeah, I know. You've been sitting there for a long time. I'm sorry, Chris. We get a lot of calls here.
Oh, well, I understand that. Maybe it was the question I was going to ask Bernie Sanders. But anyway, he was talking about solar this morning. And I wanted to ask, you know, how can we go forward with solar when the oil companies spend large amounts of money towards politicians' campaigns that will water down any progress that the solar industry tries to make? And the words campaign finance reform should be on the lips of every American in this country, thereby taking back our country from these corporations that mean us no good.
Agreed. In fact, let me take it a step further. We should have voter-owned elections. We should own the apparatus of the elections. It's crazy that we have private corporations owning a large chunk. I mean, you know, keeping track of who, not just tabulating the vote, but keeping track of who's eligible to vote, and then owning the machines on which we vote, and all that kind of. That's wrong, number one. But voter-owned elections, taking it a step farther, like they have in Maine and Arizona to some extent, like we have in Portland, Oregon, where. If somebody can get, in the case of Portland, Oregon, if you can get 1,000 people to give you $5 and sign a petition, then the city will give you $100,000 to run your campaign. And if somebody comes along with $150,000, whether it's their own money or whether it's from Enron, if they come along with $150,000, the city will give you another $50,000 so that you're always matching them. If they come along with $1 million, the city will give you $1 million. You always are able to match what's coming. And these are really truly voter owned elections, and it really works. And we need to do that nationwide. I mean, yesterday I was talking about how startled I was to learn. I mean, I learned this from Randy White, one of our sales, or ex-sales guy, used to be one of the sales guys at KPOJ. He's off, started his own business now. But Randy was sharing with me information that we later tracked down and found to be true, that one of the major forces behind prohibition in the 20s was John Rockefeller. Why? Because the first cars ran on alcohol just as well as they did gasoline, and farmers all over the country had these big stills running in their garages to distill alcohol to run their cars. And Rockefeller wanted that to be made illegal, and prohibition made that illegal. And, you know, it's all about the money.
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, those Model A's actually had a valve that would switch from gasoline to alcohol. That was one of the reasons for prohibition.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
And but anyway, getting back to, you know, our politicians and the large amounts of money that they take. I mean, everybody should take it upon themselves to, you know, you can look into what your politicians, who they're taking money from. Each politician every quarter has to fill out a campaign finance statement.
Right.
Okay. And that means who they took campaign contributions from. And you can just about go right down the line to see how they voted, and then you can look and see if they've taken money to vote in favor of something or against something.
Yep.
And this is what's wrong with our country today is, you know, money. You know,
I agree.
Absolutely.
And the large sums that
people take, I mean, these politicians take. I mean, it appears to me that only the rich in this country, all or captains of industry, ascend to these offices of politicians. and they're not going to look out for the little guy.
No, well said, Chris. In fact, the Republican Party now is looking for more Michael Bloomberg types, you know, multimillionaires or billionaires.
Absolutely.
Who can fund their own campaigns. It's,
absolutely.
And this goes back to the 1976 Supreme Court decision, Buckley versus Valeo, saying that, you know, money is speech and it doesn't corrupt the political process, and the more money you've got, the more speech you can have, and it can't be controlled because the First Amendment protects it. Chris, thank you for the call and for raising a really important point. You're absolutely right. At the root of all political evils is money, and that's what we need to get out of it. Chris in Michigan, we got about a minute before we've got to take a break. Chris, what's up?
Well, something pretty much along the same vein. My question goes to, you talked about the energy bill with Senator Bernie Sanders, and that the Republicans have gutted it. My question to you, though, is this. If I went up to most Americans and asked them, should we get away from foreign oil or get away from our dependence, they would say yes. So how come when Republicans stop something like that, how come it's not political suicide? Is it because Democrats, won't go for the jugular when it comes to the election and say, look, he wants us to be dependent on foreign oil?
Yes.
Or is it due to more to people in this country just, saying, well, I'm a Democrat, I'm going to vote Democrat, I'm a Republican, I'm going to vote Republican. They don't
50% of it, Chris, is that the Democrats have not up to this point been willing to play hardball. Really serious hardball. I mean, they have not been willing to call names. They have not been willing to call Republicans out the way the Republicans have been calling them out for years. That's half of it. The other half of it is that a significant minority of the Democratic Party is in bed with the oil companies, just like the majority of the Republican Party. And so you combine those two things, and what do you get? Is this wimp factor, and it's why we need to be out there aggressively working for progressive Democrats and getting them elected in everything from dog catcher to United States Senate all across this country. Thanks a lot for the call, Chris. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
That's what I do.
Thirty-four minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from AM 950 Air America, Minnesota, where we will be doing. I'll be doing a book signing tonight and a speech at 7 o'clock at the University of Minnesota Bookstore in Kauffman Union, 300 Washington Street Southeast, Minneapolis. Free and open to the public. Michael in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Michael. One of actually two Michaels in Los Angeles on the board here. We'll get to the other one in just a minute. Hey, what's up?
By the way, I'm a big fan, Tom.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say, I was at a dinner party in Beverly Hills, and it was attended by some pretty wealthy people, and some of them were Republicans, and I know that these people deal with Republican leadership at the RNC and other places, and they used, when we were debating about the current situation and debt and everything, they used an argument that I'd never heard before, and I was wondering if you heard it or any of your listeners heard it, and that was, they don't mind the debt spending. They don't mind it at all. They consider it as a strategy to eliminating entitlement programs.
Right.
Because basically, we're not going to be able to afford them.
Yeah.
After they bleed us dry. Have you heard this?
Yeah. In fact, probably 5 years ago on this show, I did a whole hour on this at some length because there was an article in the Wall Street Journal, and I'll have to, when I get back home, see if I can even find it now, because it was back when we lived in Vermont and we're doing the show from there. But it was one of the op-ed writers in the Wall Street Journal had laid out this theory of the good Santa Claus and the bad Santa Claus, good Santa, bad Santa, and that the Republicans were playing this game of when they got power, they would spend like drunken sailors and make, no offense to drunken sailors, by the way, and make the economy look good, stimulate the economy wildly with deficit spending. And then the Democrats would come into office and, like as Bill Clinton did, say, hey, wait a minute, we can't do this. This is ruining the country. We've got to slow down this spending or we've got to raise taxes in order to pay for, what the Republicans have been putting on the credit card. And then the Republicans get credit for the economy being good, and the Democrats get credit for the economy being bad, when in fact they're actually making it good structurally. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And this was a very explicit strategy that was laid out in the early years of the Reagan administration.
If it's true, though, then why don't we talk about it more? Because otherwise we're just going to be in this endless loop.
Yeah.
Every time we're going to come in and clean it up, and then they're going to go and mess it up.
Yeah.
And,
well,
I mean, I'll get off the phone, but I just want to say, I just think it's crazy. We need to talk about it more.
Yeah, I agree, Michael, and I think that more and more Americans are getting it, particularly the part about the credit card, you know, that the Republicans are putting everything on the credit card. And, by the way, we're paying interest on the credit card. If you're an average taxpayer, this year you will pay about $3,000 in taxes on the interest. On the interest. On the money that was borrowed by Ronald Reagan, Poppy Bush, and George W. $3,000. And why the Democrats aren't pounding that thing, why they don't have, you know, a giant thermometer or a giant check, you know, some kind of graphic in Congress that every day goes up a little bit, you know, like the debt clock in Times Square or wherever it is. You know, why the Democrats are not just pounding that thing, I don't know, because, you know, the Republicans back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s used to be all over the Democrats for things like this. And, you know, it should be, you know, what goes around comes around. Jim in Flint, Michigan. Hey, Jim. This is
hey,
WDTW.
Thank you. How you doing?
Just fine.
Good. Tom, I have a lot of dots that I want to try to connect, but I'll just make this real quick because it all boils down to, and I suspect I'm very, very much like everyone else who has any progressive thoughts in this country, and I feel schizophrenic most of the time. You know, I listen to Senator Bernie and you, and, you know, I feel a little less crazy that we are making progress. And then I read the two Naomis or, you know, Al Gore and some of the others, and I start going nuts again. And this,
well, know, they're both right.
Pardon me?
Both perspectives are right, Jim. I mean, these to paraphrase, I mean, these really are the best of times and the worst of times.
Yeah. But I guess it came together for me on a trip that I recently made out to Oceanside, California, midway between San Diego and Los Angeles. And I went to a little museum called the Museum of Making Music. And, you know, I love music of all different kinds. And this museum basically talked about instrument making, about the science behind it, the marketing of it. And when it came to the marketing, they had these little displays that described, for example, the creation of the piano manufacturing industry in this country and how that was marketed to the schools and how every school has a music program and, you know, how that all fit together and created jobs and everything else. But it really took off when tariffs were put on to make the domestic manufacturing much more profitable when compared with the imported pianos.
Right, which actually ultimately drove down the cost of pianos because it was more profitable to make them here, so more people made them here. As more people made them here, they started competing with each other, and it drove down the price.
Exactly. And, you know, your analogy, actually it's not an analogy, but a comparison to, you know, the difference in cost of manufacturing is what either makes an industry profitable in this country or destroys it. And, you know, certainly brought that home. But number two, I had to drive just about everywhere, and it's nuts driving there because of the traffic. But I was, Tom, physically ill looking at the nameplates on the vehicles. I had to search sometimes, you know, for 5 or 10 minutes before I saw a domestic nameplate on one of the vehicles out there.
Well, and you call it a domestic nameplate, but your Chevy motors are made in China.
Oh, I agree.
Your Chrysler cars are owned by a German company. You know, it's half the electronics in a Ford come from Taiwan from China.
But my point, and that's why I described it as a domestic nameplate rather than made in this country, because I certainly understand that. But of course,
and a lot of the Fords and General Motors cars are made in Mexico.
Sure, sure. But I guess the third part of it, and it's these budget battles with Mr. 25% there in the bully pulpit, and how the Democrats, you know, keep changing in order to try to get something through. But, you know, again, Senator Bernie explains a lot of that, and I understand that, believe it or not, we are actually moving the ball forward, but sometimes I feel like Sisyphus trying to push that ball up the hill. Okay. But I guess I just want to finish with this. That Bush, as you described earlier in your show today, keeps cutting and cutting and cutting all of those things that are desperately needed by those who desperately need assistance from the commons or in the commons, you know, no matter what it be, whether it be you know, union organizing or or help with education or whatever the case might be.
Well, like yesterday we were talking about fire departments.
Or fire departments. I mean, I saw a lot of that out there. I happened to go to visit a church not too far from Rancho Bernardo, as you were talking about, and it's devastating, you know, what I saw. But I guess what it boils down to, Bush always gets his war funding. He always manages to cut what everyone else needs. And I guess I want to be very cynical today and wind this up by saying that it seems that Bush and his Republican enablers' philosophy seems to be, let's screw as many people as we can here in this country so that we can get them to join the military so we can kill them over there.
Well, I would say everything except so that we can kill them. As much as I think that there is a sociopathic part of George W. Bush, I really don't think that, on a practical level, he is happy with deaths.
But there is a practical consequence to his actions in that people die.
Yeah.
Because he is enabling the military-industrial complex, and it is killing literally millions of people all around the earth. I don't care if it's his abstinence-only education in Africa, where uses of condoms, you know, substantially drives down the incidence of AIDS transmission. It just doesn't matter what it is. I mean, your example of you know, using domestic tariffs in third world countries with the World Bank, you know, those countries are now starting to prosper. But
yeah,
yet, you know, we think that the whole world should be bowing down to us. And I'm not an America hater by any stretch of the imagination, Tom, but I'm also very much a believer that we are responsible for this planet. We are responsible for all of those people in this world, that all people, I believe, are, as you've said, basically good. It's just a necessity that we provide the means for which that goodness can be demonstrated and brought forth and
right.
flourish.
Democracy, and thank you, Jim, for your comments. Well said. Democracy, small d democracy, and a strong commons, a strong infrastructure, things like a national health service, a good public education, all the way up through a PhD for free. These are things that are just standard. They're normal in the Scandinavian countries and in many of the countries of Europe. And what they are is the soil, the fertile soil in which business can grow and in which an informed electorate, in which democracy can grow. And you know, spot on that the Bushies and companies don't like that at all. To the other Michael in Los Angeles. Hey, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What's up?
I'm just responding to a couple of callers spoke about, as you said, atheism.
Right.
And I don't think that that's, you know, I think it's a kind of a, people get a derogatory of it. You know, atheism is not so much about beliefs of any or disclaiming or not even knowing. It's about, for me at least, trying to keep things real. And whether you believe in random walks or walks with God, you still have to walk through the numbers. In fact, the person who founded philosophy, which is organized religion or belief systems, one of the founding fathers was Pythagoras, no slouch on mathematics, and very much into keeping things real.
But how do you know the world is real, Michael?
You've
got photons hitting receptors at the back of your eyes, converting rhodopsin and other chemicals that produce a little electrical impulse that travels through your thalamus and eventually ends up in the occipital part of your brain in the visual cortex and
historical
produces
record,
something that looks like vision, but it's you're not
action,
actually seeing
reaction,
what's real.
Action, reaction, deductive reasoning, historical record. Those are the only things we have that are the most basic, reliable.
Okay, I'll agree with you there, and I would say that ultimately...
I don't feel threatened by Christians, but why do they feel threatened by...
Well, I don't feel threatened by atheists.
Amen.
I'm fine with atheists. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, boy. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And special thanks to David Poole and Louise Hartman producing this program, to Chris Rosen and Lauren Kirschner at Air America Radio, helping make everything work and running that thing. Mike Toth, who does our audio archives. Sue Nethercutt, who runs our chat room. And many other things. All kinds of stuff all over our website. To our advertisers, our sponsors, the folks at Air America Radio, and to Janet Robert and the folks here at AM 950 Air America Minnesota for hosting me today. Thank you to all of you. The two Santa, but just a quick note here, and then Alan Ratner, the two Santa Claus theory that we were talking about earlier, and a tip of the hat to Sue Nethercutt, who pointed this out to me on the web. There's actually a Wikipedia entry under two Santa Claus theory. Two Santa Claus theory, a political theory and strategy developed by Jude Waninsky in 1976, which he promoted within the U.S. Republican Party. The theory states that in Democratic elections, if one party appeals to voters by proposing more spending, then a competing party cannot gain broader appeal by proposing less spending. The Santa Claus of the theory title refers to the political party that promises spending. Instead, two Santa Claus theory recommends that the competing party must assume the role of a second Santa Claus by offering other appealing options. And then he gets through this whole thing of the Laffer curve and supply-side economics and so on. And he says, Waninsky argued that Republicans must become the tax-cutting Santa Claus to the Democrats' spending Santa Claus. So there you go. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C., on the line with us. Hey, Ellen, what's going on in Washington today?
First of all, I want to say that Shalene Espinoza will be in the lead story on 60 Minutes on Sunday on Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
So please set your TiVos or DRs or whatever you call them, or just be there and watch it, because Shalene is just one of the finest people on earth and has an important story to tell.
And we are hoping that this begins some turnaround, and by giving some of the Blue Dogs some political cover that they need, because a lot of these guys want to do the right thing, but they're really afraid to in their various districts. Meanwhile, the president today said that he is thinking that in terms of the continuing resolution, as you know, the budget turns into a pumpkin today, and that they would think about a year-long continuing resolution. I've actually never heard of that, but I guess it's doable. And this, instead of an omnibus appropriations bill with different various things in it, Christmas tree ornaments, et cetera, that this would, in fact, be just a continuation of the 2007 budget. And the president today said that he would now accept what he called a down payment of Iraq. Somewhere, people think, about $50 billion rather than $200 that he essentially asked for, and that as long as it did not include something around mandatory troop withdrawal.
Interesting. Is this a compromise, or is this just, you know, as strategic, he's going to get what he wants in the end anyway, so might as well do it this way and make it look like he's compromising?
I think it's the latter.
Yeah, that was my guess,
I think they want him to look like he's compromised.
Yeah.
Now, also today, there is some word on the street that the United States and the European Union at the UN Climate Change Conference in Bali have agreed to put some general goals together to reduce greenhouse emissions in half. Now, I don't want you to be moving from your chair by the year 2050.
Oh, man. And they're talking about the Arctic being ice-free in 6 years.
Exactly.
This is incredible.
Exactly.
I mean, in today's Wall Street Journal, the front page of the second section, the marketplace section, the B section, the headline, geochemists chart carbon dioxide levels at 650,000-year high.
That's right. 2050, first of all, you and I will be long gone. And even some people of our generation's children might even be long gone. And they're talking about reducing it in half as a written goal. And that's what we got out of the Bali conference.
This is tragic.
It's very disturbing. Meanwhile, today, Democrats.com had a little conference on the web. Democratic Robert Wexler, he's up from Florida, and he said that he wants to co-sponsor a House Judiciary Committee a possibility of impeachment hearings for Vice President Cheney, and he said mainstream media has no interest in this issue, no matter the vast majority of Americans correctly believe that Dick Cheney has abused his power of office.
So, any reason why?
No, I mean, I didn't attend the whole conference, so I'm not sure, but clearly that he wants to get that moving, and maybe he'll get some people behind him or not.
Yeah.
And last but not least, well, I could go on with several things, but today Scott Stenzel in the press conference talked about the president and the administration issuing a statement on the policy that was passed by the House last night, ending waterboarding, and said that, listen to this, because it just doesn't make any sense. The administration does strongly oppose any legislation that would extend protections and requirements of the Army Field Manual to the CIA detention and interrogation program. Because you have the Defense Department that has the Field Manual that's there to address interrogations that occur by defense personnel on the battlefield during those conflicts in a normal battlefield setting.
In other words,
that's something we would hear on Saturday Night Live, I think.
Well, it sounds like what they're trying to say is that this so-called war on terror is a different thing than the war against Hitler, for example. And it is. It's a hallucination. It's like the war on drugs. It's an abstraction. But they're claiming all these rights and powers as a consequence of this abstraction.
It is, yes, absolutely, and I agree with you, but that is what the gobbledygooker was at the White House today.
Amazing, amazing. Well, Ellen, thank you so much for keeping us up to date.
Thank you, and watch 60 Minutes.
Okay, will do. 60 Minutes Sunday night. Charlene Espinosa will be there. Ellen, thanks again. 57 minutes past the, well, it's the end of the show. Thanks so much for being with us today. It is much appreciated, and we will be back. We'll be tonight at at the University of Minnesota Bookstore, Kauffman Union, signing books, and Monday we'll be back here on the show. So don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you Monday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.